Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today in foreign policy circles, you'll hear a lot about soft power, a way of influencing other countries through the attractiveness of the country's culture, political ideals, or economic policies. While soft power is a relatively new term in diplomacy, this benign way of influencing other nations is at the heart of public diplomacy. My guest today is a specialist on the history of America's public diplomacy, which really got underway in earnest in the 1930s as FDR realized the U.S. was going to have to shed its isolationistic views. Public diplomacy has resulted in a number of important Cold War-era programs that enhance the U.S.'s image abroad, the Fulbright Scholars Program, the Voice of America Radio, State Department cultural exchanges, which sent artists like Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Dizzy Gillespie around the world. Well, since the end of the Cold War, a lot of our efforts at public diplomacy have fallen off. But since 9/11, the U.S. has tried to reinvigorate its public diplomacy efforts, but with marginal success so far. Justin Hart is an associate professor of history at Texas Tech University, and he's the author of Empire of Ideas, The Origins of Public Diplomacy and the Transformation of U.S. Foreign Policy. He was a guest at the University of Tulsa last night, and he'll be speaking to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations this evening, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Justin Hart, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
You've been writing quite a bit on America's public diplomacy, and your book really focuses on what you would call the beginning of organized public diplomacy. And
yes.
I was reading a criticism of the book, and they were saying the Declaration of Independence was public diplomacy. but you're really talking about the 1930s when America was still basically isolationist.
Right.
But we were beginning to think of our role in the larger world and seeing the vacuum that democracies had in the organized world with
right.
the diminution of the British Empire. So where does it all begin? When do we start thinking about our image to the rest of the world?
Well, I think the criticism that the Declaration of Independence is targeted towards the world is a fair point. It is, and there's plenty of scholarship that indicates that the author of the Declaration had a global audience in mind. What I really focus on is the way that the State Department, the official foreign policy apparatus, started to take America's image in the world seriously as a factor that they had to account for in the making of foreign policy. And so it's one thing to say that there's an image and that it exists, but to think consciously about how to shape it, how to manipulate it, how to massage it, that's something that starts in the mid-1930s. And you're right to point out that that's the context of isolationism in the United States. And it began in Latin America, where the Roosevelt administration, Franklin Roosevelt administration, tested out many of the theories that they would later hope to apply to the rest of the world. It was kind of a covert internationalism, what they were trying to do in Latin America.
Do you think the emergence of public diplomacy goes hand in hand with sort of the emergence of mass media? Because all of a sudden, it's not just newspapers anymore where a diplomat can give an interview on a great background, but all of a sudden, news is becoming a 24-hour event, even primitive compared to today, but
sure.
But certainly with mass media, you're starting to see that events from around the world are coming to viewers or listeners in a much quicker way.
Yes and no is the okay. answer to that. It is not solely a response to mass media in the sense that mass media does go back before the 1930s. But what you had during the 1930s was a collection of policymakers who realized that the United States was arriving at a moment in history when it was positioned potentially to succeed Great Britain as the world's dominant power, and that given the speed of mass communications in that era, if they wanted to establish a global scope to U.S. foreign policy, they had to consider the ways that what Woodrow Wilson referred to as the whispering gallery of the world, the way that the United States was discussed in the whispering gallery of the world.
Now, I assume the country had always embarked on public diplomacy during wartime, say
mm-hmm.
within the Union, during the Civil War, certainly during World War I, which you write about in your book, but we hadn't done it in peacetime.
That's really the key, is that the main precursor to what the Roosevelt people were doing in the 1930s and especially moving into the 1940s was the so-called Creel Committee, or the Committee on Public Information that Woodrow Wilson set up during World War I. But George Creel, who was a progressive-era journalist who ran that, was very clear that in his mind that was simply a war organization.
And a propaganda organization.
And a propaganda organization. And that what Roosevelt had in mind was something that would be permanent, that it would transform the way foreign policy was conceptualized, and that it would exist regardless of whether the United States faced clear external enemies. Although when Germany and Japan come along and later the Soviet Union, that certainly gives a greater impetus to what they already had in mind.
Right. And propaganda is a part of public diplomacy,
but it's
not wholly propaganda.
That's exactly right. Propaganda delivered via radio or print media or ultimately television, the internet, film, that is part of public diplomacy, but so are cultural exhibits overseas, cultural tours, overseas libraries, educational exchanges. So all of these things are part of a mechanism that is overall designed to shape America's image in the world. That is what I come back to time and again, is that they are all different techniques with the common goal of shaping the way the United States is perceived as much as the government can do that.
And one of the first efforts was in 1936 in Buenos Aires, a major conference of all the countries of the Western Hemisphere, the Americas, if you will.
Yes.
And
they called it the American Republics.
Yeah.
That was their phrase.
Franklin Roosevelt actually traveled via ship down to Buenos Aires to address the conference.
Yes.
And he had this big idea. It was a small idea, but it became really a rather large idea, which was for all of the nation states to send a couple of people to study in the United States each year.
And vice versa.
Yeah.
And for the United States to send people to each of the other American republics. And what I found when I went into the archives and researched the origins of these programs is that they always had bigger goals in mind. This was never about just shipping a couple people here and there. They always had an agenda that was about shaping the image of the United States and Latin America through these exchanges, and ultimately to expand these programs to the rest of the world, which is what they did during World War II.
Now, how much exchange of educational ideas were there prior to this program? I mean, study abroad programs were probably not a big part of American universities, but I would assume there were still people going to Oxford, the Sorbonne, University of Berlin.
The Rhodes Scholarship is one of the models for this.
Yeah, but some of the great old schools of European learning, like the Sorbonne and University of Berlin and those sorts of places, there were probably people going over there. Were there people coming to the United States, though?
The distinction is between private, non-governmental organizations sponsoring this and the U.S. government being in this business. And so the policymakers who were responsible for the Latin American exchanges into the late 1930s were really looking at organizations like the Institute for International Education, which was part of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And they had already engaged in these sorts of things going back.
So it wasn't unheard of for scholars to go, American scholars to go throughout the Americas and various Latin American countries coming to the United States.
Particularly Europe. I'm sure it happened somewhat in Latin America, but I would think that the major impetus for something like the Institute of International Education was to place people in Europe.
All right. So what sort of influence did this have? Did the war curtail this at all, or did it actually get started in the mid-30s?
It actually started it took a couple years to set it up. So as you mentioned, 1936, the agreement is signed at Buenos Aires. By 1938, the State Department has established what they call a Division of Cultural Relations. And initially, its goal is to supervise this project of exchanging a couple graduate students is where they started per year per country. And through World War II, they sensed that there was a real opportunity here to take this worldwide and to add a variety of other techniques to the mix. And ultimately, there's a propaganda organization called the Office of War Information that emerges on a really parallel track, not touching at that point, but a parallel track during World War II, and then all of that gets combined into one office in 1945 that is the precursor to what we refer to as public diplomacy, which is a term that it kicked around in the early part of the 20th century and into the mid part of the 20th century. It wasn't widely used in the sense that we use it today until a man named Edmund Gullion, who was the dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University, he applied it to these initiatives that already existed. And since the early 1960s, we've referred to these initiatives as public diplomacy.
So in the early days when this scholar program got underway, did it have any influence on how the United States was regarded, say, within its hemisphere?
Well, it got good press, for sure. Mm-hmm. And it was part and parcel, as I mentioned, of Franklin Roosevelt's good neighbor policy, which was the idea that he outlined in the first inaugural address, the one that's more famous for "We have nothing to fear but fear itself," but also in that address was a line about the United States being a good neighbor in U.S. foreign policy, and this became applied particularly to Latin America.
Which we've had a mixed success with Latin America. We are either dictating them or ignoring them.
Yeah, that would be the best. Mixed is the best possible adjective you could put to that. I think during the Roosevelt years, there was an improvement in the perception of the United States in Latin America.
Now, after the war and the Cold War begins, All of a sudden, all this public diplomacy becomes very focused. It also becomes a source of backlash.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised to know, along with Joe McCarthy, you know, deriding the communists in the State Department, he was also deriding all these sort of scholarly exchanges as well. This was a political issue.
It's inherently political if you consider that any time you are setting out an agenda that uses ideas to shape the way the United States is perceived, one of the things I say in the book is that in order to project America, which is the term that a lot of these people use, in order to project America, you first have to define America. And when you define America, that's an inherently political endeavor. And so someone like McCarthy was rightly, I guess you could say, concerned about what ideas would be exchanged. And I don't agree with McCarthy's priorities there, but he was correct that this was potentially an explosive situation.
And how big a backlash was this during the 1950s?
It was huge. He was almost single-handedly responsible for taking the public diplomacy initiatives out of the State Department and creating what was known as the United States Information Agency, which was a decision that had been proposed many times over the years. And Dwight Eisenhower, it was shortly into Eisenhower's presidency when this occurred, had already been leaning in that direction. But McCarthy's inquisition of the public diplomacy programs, which came relatively late in his tenure of being at the forefront of national political discussion, he went after a lot of the other parts of the State Department under Truman, but really left the public diplomacy shop alone until when Eisenhower came into office. And then he went after the Voice of America. He went after the overseas libraries and went after the foreign exchanges, as you mentioned.
What could be controversial about Voice of America? That, you know, the Voice of America was, by most accounts, was very influential in the Cold War as far as an honest, fairly honest portrayal of American life, American politics, devoid of any see-through propaganda, if you will.
Yeah. Well, I don't mean to be flip in saying this, but not everyone is interested in an honest portrayal of American life.
and that was at the heart of it.
Yeah.
My guest today is Justin Hart. He's associate professor of history at Texas Tech University, author of Empire of Ideas, The Origins of Public Diplomacy and the Transformation of U.S. Foreign Policy. And the book, again, focuses on the beginning and certainly how it
up to the creation of the United States Information Agency.
Yeah, and how it worked under the State Department. And
that's right.
I assume after the war, all these public diplomacy elements really grew quite extensively. During the war, you obviously had a huge propaganda element in the war effort.
Right.
But once the war effort ends and all of a sudden the government almost flips that it's, you know, Soviet Union is the new enemy.
Right.
And so public diplomacy takes on a huge edge in the late 40s and early 50s. Give us a sense of the scope of what we were doing at that time.
Well, you can frame that two different ways. It, certainly compared to where it starts with the educational exchanges to students per year per country in 1938, it grows massively and adds a huge propaganda component during World War II that then gets integrated into the State Department. So you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. Compared to the budget for a plane or a tank or military expenditures, it's microscopic, which is one of the arguments actually that public diplomats tried to make, is that, hey, maybe we can make a difference or maybe we can't, but why don't you give it a shot? Because in terms of cost effectiveness, we cost a fraction of what you're spending on the national security state.
And so after the war, you had expansion of the educational programs.
Sure, with the creation of the Fulbright program.
When did the Voice of America start? Would it start right after the war?
No, it started
during
World War II,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
and then was incorporated into the State Department after World War II.
And then when did you start seeing things like cultural exchanges and things like that?
Those start during the war as well. For example, the composer Aaron Copland was sent down to Latin America during World War II. And so the tours of Louis Armstrong and the jazz ambassadors and that sort of thing during the Cold War are the more famous of those exchanges. But what happened was that in addition to the State Department, another part of the decentralized bureaucracy was that Nelson Rockefeller, the son of the oil magnate, ran another separate agency that dealt with cultural relations with Latin America. And he was much better funded than the State Department was, not from his own personal funding, but
right.
He was funded directly out of Franklin Roosevelt's President's Fund. And so he actually expanded and pushed the State Department to consider what they were already doing in a broader light. And so a lot of these cultural exchanges that you see in the Cold War, the precursors once again are in World War II.
So once we get to the Cold War, public diplomacy becomes a big part of our foreign policy, mm-hmm. and even with the U.S.
USIA.
You're seeing public diplomacy as a big part of this effort. What was most effective during the Cold War? Have you studied what had the greatest impact on how the rest of the world viewed the United States during this?
That's sort of the million-dollar question for those of us who study public diplomacy, is how do we gauge the impact of these programs? It's a lot easier to chart what U.S. officials tried to do, what they thought they were doing. You can look at foreign press. You can look at records from other countries and the way that they respond. There's been a lot of work done on the broadcasts of a tangent to the Voice of America called Radio Free Europe.
Yeah, when I was a kid, you remember the advertising about Radio Free Europe.
And that's broadcasting behind the Iron Curtain.
Right.
And there's a fair amount of scholarship from people who have gone into the archives in those post-communist countries suggesting that Radio Free Europe did have a real impact in terms of
from governmental response.
In terms of people in those countries questioning what they were being told by the official propagandists in their country.
But there's really no way of really knowing how, say, Voice of America, how these were viewed by the average person around the world?
Well, what you have to do is do research on a country-by-country basis, and
right.
That's something that there hasn't been enough of that kind of research. And so it's conceivable that you could actually answer those questions if you went country-by-country. But in a broader sense, something like Voice of America, it depends what period you're talking about, because the people who are running the Voice have more and less commitment to an accurate reflection of the news, whether they are really trying to cover what's going on in the United States or whether they're trying to sanitize it.
Mm.
And one of the points that I make in the book is that what the public diplomats were doing was really a few drops in a very large bucket that is comprised of the massive private media in the United States. And so they faced great difficulty. We kind of think of U.S. officials as all-powerful, U.S. government officials as all-powerful. But in the cultural realm, they were relatively impotent.
And that's hard to, and it's hard to get our heads around that today, because when you think of the media landscape, say, in the 1950s and early 1960s, it's still a trickle compared to Niagara Falls compared to today.
Sure, with complete decentralization and the internet and that sort of thing. But even then, when you're talking about all of these newspapers around the country, one of the topics that comes up a lot in the foreign press that was really harped on first by Japanese propagandists and then later by Soviet propagandists was racial discrimination, racial violence inside the United States. And so when lynchings were reported, when the civil rights movement takes off and the sit-ins and the boycotts are reported, that's something that public diplomats have to figure out how to deal with, and they would prefer not to, of course. But they can't ignore it because of the private media in the United States reporting things that then get picked up in the foreign press. And so it becomes a very delicate question for them.
And I would think that the effectiveness of public diplomacy waxes and wanes depending on what your nation is doing at the particular time. I would think during the Vietnam era and certainly the civil rights era, it waned because you had this disconnect between what we were saying officially through public diplomacy and the reality of what was on the ground in Vietnam, in you know other places. Same in the what's happened in the post 9/11 world. We revived these public diplomacy efforts after 9/11,
sure,
but the messages were sort of mixed from what you were seeing.
Yeah, one of the difficulties that public diplomats face is deciding whether their job is to simply publicize or spin foreign policies that are decided outside of their control, or whether they are actually trying to shape the kinds of policy choices that are made based on the impact that it will have on America's image. And they go back and forth between sometimes they say that policies can't speak for themselves and that their job is to speak for these policies. And other times they argue that words have no impact without deeds. And so their words are only as effective as the policy itself. And you see them kind of wrestling with what their role is in all of this throughout this period.
You know, you contrast that with something like the BBC World Service, which is an arm of government. And I'm sure it is viewed as a public diplomacy arm within the country. But it's always taken a fairly independent view from their government. They're quick, and sometimes people within the government would say they're too quick.
Yeah,
they jump the gun on the facts sometimes, depicting scandals within their country, of reporting critically on their nation's policies. But I would think that sort of enhances the world view of Britain around the world, as here they're sponsoring this service that goes to virtually every nation in the world in their own language, and they're reporting warts and all.
There's no question that the BBC is one of the great public diplomacy initiatives in the world, and you're absolutely right that one of the reasons that maybe the main reason it's so effective is because they have a reputation, at least, of honesty and candor. And that's something that American public diplomats have generally not had as much of a luxury in terms of being able to say what they really think it's important to say for their credibility. They are always balancing credibility with viability, and there are too many people who are wanting to sanitize the way the United States is presented in the world. There are massive debates in Congress over the content of Voice of America broadcasts, and detectives, congressional representatives who play detective, constantly on the hunt for what they deem to be anti-American. And this is well before McCarthy. McCarthy, as in so many other things, was not original. He was simply better at publicizing techniques that were developed by others and accusations that were developed by others.
You also were speaking about the Fulbright Scholar Program, which has brought lots of scholars to America and sent equally American scholars all over the world. Has this been a powerful public diplomacy tool in your mind?
No question. It's one of the great successes of American public diplomacy. The only point I would make in addition to that is that Fulbright, too, serves political purposes, and that they are not as overt as something like the Voice of America. But if you go back and look at what Fulbright was trying to do in the 1940s, he was not solely concerned with improving communication across national boundaries. He was also concerned with the way the United States was perceived in the world. He wanted to ensure that the United States did, in fact, succeed Great Britain as the world's dominant superpower, and he saw these exchanges as part of that process. And that, to me, doesn't negate their importance. It doesn't diminish them. It's just something to keep in mind is that when you're exchanging ideas, there's always a political component to it, even with the Fulbright program. Who goes and who doesn't go? And like you said with McCarthy, keeping communists out of the United States was a big priority of the early Fulbright program. Whether the United States would send people to communist countries, generally the answer was no. And so there's always been a political agenda to even something like Fulbright, which is ostensibly nonpartisan.
And so today, that same criteria may be a radical viewpoint.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. Some sort of radical viewpoint, which is what it was then. Communism was seen as radical in that context, and today we would probably attach a religious label to it.
Yeah. You're also talking about some of the contemporary efforts. What would be your critique of our contemporary public diplomacy?
Well, the point I'm going to make at the Council on Foreign Relations tonight is that going back to the idea that public diplomats, their influence is really quite limited, and even more so today than it was 60, 70 years ago, as things have just been dispersed, power has been dispersed. And so I think that there are a couple things that we could do to improve the way that we account for public diplomacy in foreign policy making, one of which is for the people who actually make the decisions in terms of hard power, military, economics, for them to consider the soft power implications of what they're doing. I think that the public diplomacy shop is too often seen as just the megaphone for the people who make the real decisions, and that what should be considered when we make foreign policy decisions is, what is the impact going to be on America's soft power? What is the impact on the image going to be? And so that is the main consideration that I think is not often taken into account when we formulate foreign policy.
All right. Well, Professor Hart, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Really nice to be here. Thank you.
Justin Hart is an associate professor of history at Texas Tech University and the author of Empire of Ideas, The Origins of Public Diplomacy and the Transformation of U.S. Foreign Policy. It's published by Oxford University Press. He was a guest of the University of Tulsa Center for Global Education, as well as the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.